TV party, all right.
All right. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We are live in the Skyline studio here until 5 a.m. It is Thursday, Triple Play Thursday. Get your requests in now. One artist, three songs, 312-981-7200, 312-981-7200. Because It, Chapter 2, is coming out this weekend, we're going to talk about some fascinating facts about your favorite horror movies, and we're going to talk about the scariest books ever written. In honor of that sequel, which is being released this weekend. So that's all coming up. 312-981-7200. But right now, it is that time. Every 2 weeks, we talk with Dan Feinberg, TV critic for The Hollywood Reporter. You can follow him on Twitter and Facebook at The Fine Print, F-I-E-N. And we talk TV. There's a lot of TV to talk about, and he's with us every couple of weeks. So let's bring Dan on right now. Hey, Dan, welcome back to the show.
Thank you much, Nick.
How are you?
I'm okay, just enjoying the end of the late summer rush of TV and bracing myself for the start of the fall rush of TV.
Yes.
Once upon a time, there used to be a downtime, but as we always say, no such thing anymore.
Not anymore. We were talking a little bit about some of the new fall shows that people are interested in, like some of the network things. And the one that still stands out for me, which we can talk about later when you're allowed to talk about it, as I've mentioned before, is Evil on CBS. That's the one that I'm most intrigued by.
I am definitely hoping that I get to see a couple more episodes, or at least one more episode, before I get to talk about that, because I need a better sense of what the show is. It remains intriguing, and you know, it's been so long since there's been a genuinely intriguing network drama that it would be nice if one of several kind of iffy shows on the fall slates actually emerges into something good. I'll believe it when I see it, though.
Okay. Have you seen Mixed-ish?
I have seen Mixed-ish, and it is another one where, like almost everything else this fall, I don't know that it's necessarily a uniformly awful fall. I feel like last fall was uniformly awful, and I could have told you right up front nearly everything was going to be bad, and anything that became okay was almost a shocker. Just about everything this fall could maybe get good, potentially, but I need to see more episodes. So I'm hoping that the network's gotten far enough lead time on the fall shows that maybe we'll get two episodes of a few shows, or three, heaven forbid, because I want to see how a bunch of things evolve.
Okay. Another one that I'm kind of in, because I like Colby Smulders so much, I'm interested in Stumptown. They've been advertising that one pretty heavily, too.
And guess what? That's another one of the ones that's in the it could be good range, but I would love to see a second episode so I can see what the actual show is. It's a challenge of the fall season, is that I'm kind of basing everything off of one episode or two if I'm lucky, as opposed to when I review a show from Netflix or Amazon or whatever, where for the most part I've seen 4, 6, 8 the entire season of episodes. So it puts the networks at a disadvantage that they're already at anyway, because they have all the time restrictions, content restrictions, etc., and they have yet to figure out how to combat the disparity between what cable and streaming services are able to do in terms of outlay of episodes, not just to critics, but just in terms of how many episodes they've actually been able to see and process before they're putting them on the air. Instead, for the most part, the broadcast networks are in a old model where they're putting stuff on air where they've only seen one or two episodes as well. It's an old school model, and I don't want to say it's broken, but it's not working out well in terms of quality, and things could be done better.
Well, what have you heard about Watchmen?
Watchmen, that is one where I've seen one episode, and I can tell you that I'm very intrigued, and I anticipate hopefully seeing more episodes. It is big and meaty and substantive. That is not a review, because I'm definitely embargoed on reviews, but it is not an insignificant thing. So that is a compliment from me. It is a thing that requires processing. The question on the show is going to be whether A, audiences are prepared to be processing things, And if that's what they want, and if, you know, just if it's going to continue to be that strong. But I have a lot of faith in Damon Lindelof after Leftovers. It's kind of the gap between people who only think of Damon Lindelof in terms of Lost and maybe Prometheus, and they're like, ruined Lost was horrible, blah, 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 he's awful, he's a hack. And the people who watched Leftovers and saw that he guided that series through a three-season arc that was verging on perfection. So if you're just in the I only know him from Lost and Prometheus camp, you're probably not giving him any faith, whereas your friendly neighborhood TV critic, who most likely loved Leftovers, is feeling right now like Damon Lindelof has at least some leeway. So it's a difference in audience responses, and I feel like, you know, maybe the casual viewer who might like the show might have trepidation that a TV critic might not. I am genuinely looking forward to more episodes of the network stuff. For the most part, it's I would like it because I would like to give the stuff more chances.
Got it.
And to actually do justice to it. But Watchmen, I want to see
in a few weeks. We'll be able to talk, you know, with the embargo will be lifted, you'll be able to review some of these
Looking forward to it. That one is October. So, definitely there's time to build up anticipation and appetite, and I certainly am ready to see more.
Okay, and one more that I want to what do you know about Mr. In Between on FX?
Well, did you watch the first season of that one or not?
No, I haven't.
Oh, okay. That one is the first season is out there, and it's entertaining and quirky, and I think you would probably like it. It is sort of violent and edgy, and it's a very FX-y kind of dark comedy, and the first season is only 6 episodes. They're short episodes. And I personally need to watch the last one or two of them because things just sort of get rolled up. And even if I love things, sometimes I fall behind. But yeah, you should definitely check out the first season of that one because it's very interesting. I don't know that it's going to be for everyone, but I think it has a solid sensibility and some interesting performances and tonal things that people don't necessarily know. And it's a very much under the radar show, I feel like, because I didn't even
know about it. Seriously, I didn't even know about it. And I watch FX all the time. I know that they've been advertising, you know, the premiere like crazy on FX now, but I just don't, I don't remember it being in my wheelhouse at all.
They ran through it very quickly. It was only, I think, a 6-episode first season. They acquired it out of Sundance. It was produced for FX in Australia, which is not directly tied to FX in the States, but FX in the States picked it up. And I think that they may have, my memory could be wrong on this, have doubled up episodes, so it might have only aired in a 3-week period.
Oh, I see.
But even if it did air over 6 weeks, and I really think it might have been doubled up, because it's a half-hour show, I think it just went by so quickly that if you didn't process it, and it wasn't, you know, it was well received, but it wasn't buzzy in the same way that a lot of FX shows are, and it has a lot to do with the fact that the cast is relative unknowns to people in the States. But yeah, only 6 episodes. You can burn through that one in a hurry and either get excited for season 2 or move on because there's a lot of TV.
All right. By the way, you were right about Lodge 49. I should have been watching that show from the beginning. That, I got to say, I don't know how the hell you can write about it. I don't know how anybody can talk about it's one of the craziest shows I've ever seen, but it is so good and so strange and so original. I love it. I think it's great. And my friend David Pasquese is fantastic on it. It's like some of the best work he's ever done.
The entire cast is terrific. It is a remarkable cast. My review praised the casting directors to the sky because every part is well selected, and so many of the people in it are you know, just working character actors and you know, people who do, you know, Chicago theater, New York theater, who are that kind of actor who under normal circumstances would pop up in an episode or two of things and you'd go, okay, that was a colorful, good performance there. And here they're regulars. You know, Brent Jennings, who's pretty much the second lead in the show, is this guy who's just done one-off guest spots his entire career, and suddenly somebody said, here, you're now number 2 on a call sheet, have fun. He's fantastic.
Yeah.
Um, Sonia Cassidy, who's the female lead, is a British actress. I am really good with the accent game. I get annoyed so fast with British and Aussie actors coming stateside and doing kind of flat American accents and not being good. I was shocked because I hadn't seen her in Humans, which was on AMC, and some people like, I just hadn't seen it. And she's remarkable. It is such a good cast, and it is such an indescribable show.
It is.
And when you tell people, you've just got to catch the vibe and go with it.
Right.
It throws people off, I think.
I agree. I don't even know what to say about it. It is so just, I've never seen anything like it. And I love Wyatt Russell, and every time I see him from Overlord or anything else that he's been in, there are moments when he looks and sounds exactly like his dad. And you know, sometimes he doesn't, but then there are moments where you go, oh my God, he looks exactly like Kurt Russell. And he's really great in the show, like really great.
It's another show that we like that not everyone is going to like, but it is definitely a show that more people would like than are currently watching it. So I'm just trying to get people to watch it because it's not going to last forever if people don't check it out, and a lot of people would like it. Some people wouldn't, and if it's not your vibe, it's not your vibe. But I figured it would be your vibe, and I think a lot of people.
No, you were absolutely right. I love it. I think it's great. It's on AMC. It's Lodge 49, and it's we can't describe it, but trust us, it's really original, really really great, and filled with amazing performances. So thank you for that and insisting on that I watch it, Dan, because you were right on the money with that.
Glad you actually dug in and enjoyed it.
Okay, all right, Dan, hang on a second. All right.
Sure.
Okay, Dan Feinberg is with us. He joins us every 2 weeks to talk TV. We're going to break for the news, and then after the news, we'll jump right back in. Lots of TV to talk about right here on 720 WGN.
Stop shopping, even. Stop buying things.
Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We are live in the WGN Skyline Studio, 18 stories above beautiful downtown Chicago, here till 5 a.m., as we are every weekday morning. It is Thursday. That means Triple Play Thursday. Get your requests in now. One artist, three songs. We'll play them later. 312-981-7200, 312-981-7200. As I'm sure everybody on the planet knows, unless you've been living in a cabin somewhere, It Chapter 2 opens this weekend. It's the much anticipated sequel to the movie and continuation based on the Stephen King novel. So we're going to talk a little bit about that. And then I've got some great and fun, fascinating facts about your favorite horror movies. And we're going to talk about some of the scariest books ever written. That's all in honor of the release of It Chapter 2. But right now, we are talking with Dan Feinberg, TV critic for The Hollywood Reporter. You can follow him on Twitter and Facebook at The Fine Print, F-I-E-N. Let's get back to talking TV with Dan. Dan, welcome back.
Thank you, Nick.
Okay, a couple of HBO things I wanted to talk about. How do you feel about them moving The Deuce to Monday?
I think that, it sort of goes multiple ways. The first way to look at it is, it's the last season, and they don't need to worry about having it in the quote-unquote Sunday spot, whatever it is. And currently they have Succession there, and Succession is phenomenal.
Yes.
And
yes.
So it's just there, and I assume we're going to talk about Succession after we talk about
yes,
this. So
we
not,
are. Yes, we are.
I'm not jumping ahead. It's not like it needs to be in the prestige Sunday spot, and also, thanks to Chernobyl and Gentleman Jack to some degree, the Monday slot has, in the past few months, become a really reputable place for HBO to be programming. It was never like a dumping ground, but it was the place where HBO programmed their documentaries, and it was a great slot for that. They've decided to expand into more different scripted potential slots, including the Friday night slot that they've been using in the 11 p.m. hour for Los Espookies and for Black Lady Sketch Show. So, they're going into these different areas as opposed to just every single week being, okay, the prestige slot is Sunday nights from 9 to 11. That's what it is. And so, to me, it's perfectly fine, and it's saying, once again, we put legitimate shows in this place, shows that we respect, shows we like. I have now caught up on through the second season of The Deuce, so I am ready to start on the third season. I have not watched any screeners yet, but I am now caught up through season two and looking forward to season three, hoping it ends well, because for the most part, David Simon ends his shows well, even if you don't think that season five of The Wire was the best season of The Wire, which it's not. It still ended reasonably well. Terme ended reasonably well, etc. Yeah. So
I thought I don't think season five is the best season of The Wire. I'm in the minority because I think season two is the best season of The Wire. I'm way in the minority on that. Everybody thinks that's the weakest season, the season that takes place on the docks. That's my favorite season.
It is. Anyone who thinks it's the weakest season is just wrong. They're just not paying attention. They're frustrated because it doesn't have all the characters
right.
who they loved in the first season and the third season. And to me, that's not an illegitimate problem, because you can be like, okay, I miss those characters.
Yeah.
But it is wrong to say that the second season is bad or lesser. To me, the second season is significantly better than the fifth season, and I think the second season is a fantastic season of TV. I personally prefer the third season, but that's just a preference.
Well, you know, it's at this point, it's like that is beyond using the word nitpicking when it comes to The Wire, because every season is brilliant. Every episode is great. It's the best TV show that's ever been on TV, and I thought he wrapped it up beautifully in season five, even if the entire season wasn't as great as some other seasons. But I thought that final episode with everything being wrapped up was amazing. It was absolutely amazing.
It's a little too neat. A little too neat in an entire series that was all about how neatness is impossible in a city like Baltimore. And the ending to me is just a bit too clean and too final. Mm-hmm. And David Simon saying, okay, I know I have to end it. I would have loved it to have been a little bit messier in the way that the entire series was up until that point. It's still a great season of TV.
Yeah.
To me, it's just of the five, the least, whatever.
I remember the episode where, because my ex-wife and I used to watch The Wire, obviously religiously. And so her favorite character, like most people's favorite character on The Wire, is Omar. And so HBO was doing this thing back then where they were showing the following week's episode before they would air it, and it was available on demand. So I would watch them sometimes, because of my schedule, I get home and my ex-wife would be asleep. And so I would watch the episode sometimes ahead of time. Which, of course, she wasn't thrilled about, because it's one of those things where couples need to watch stuff together. I don't understand that, but that's a thing. But anyway, so I the episode where they kill off Omar, I watched before her. She was asleep. And, of course, I was completely shocked when Omar got killed, and how they handled it was just so brilliant. She loved Omar. So the next night, the next day, she gets up, and I was going to go out with her brother. In fact, and we were like, okay, let's sit and watch. Because I just wanted to see her reaction. So I said, before we go out, we were going to go and have some drinks at the bar. I said, let's watch a little bit of The Wire here. And so she's watching it, and I'm watching her. And it gets to the point, like 20 minutes into the episode, when they kill off Omar, and I could not believe her reaction. It was like, like her face like completely went, it drained. And then she looked at me, because she knew I had watched the episode, and she said, why didn't you tell me? And I'm like, are you kidding me? I'm going to tell you that they killed off Omar in the episode? Are you kidding me? But it was like one of the most insane things I've ever witnessed, because I'd already seen it. So when the scene was coming up, when he walked into the convenience store, I just started watching her, and it was pretty amazing to watch. That's how connected people were, at least some of us were, to that show.
And it was, it's a great season of TV, the fifth season, and it's a great series, and the second season of The Wire is fantastic, and anyone who tries to tell you otherwise, just move on and don't trust their opinion on that particular thing.
Right.
I'm sure they have fine opinions on other things, but on that right. particular issue, they are incorrect.
Yeah. All right, let's get to Succession now. If the episode before last, if people were ever wondering if the definite question of whether the show is a comedy or not, that question was answered the week before last in what I thought was an absolutely hilarious episode. And anybody who doubts that there's a comedic element to the show, a huge comedic element to the show, is crazy if they watched that episode and didn't think so.
Anybody who doubts that there's a comedic element, for sure.
Yeah.
There are a couple people I follow on Twitter who have incorrect opinions, who are like, is it intentionally trying to be funny? Of course it is.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, this past week's episode, and we don't want to give anything away, is simultaneously laugh-out-loud hilarious,
yes,
and soul-crushingly sad. It's both.
Yes. Yeah, it is. Now, you interviewed Jeremy Strong. How'd that go?
Terrifically. He's one of those theater-trained actors, darn it. And so, you know, I think he might be Yale drama, but we talked for 25 minutes. He's dropping references to Chekhov and Dostoevsky and the Manchurian Candidate and The Revenant, and he's just, you know, referencing things left and right, and he is smart, and because his character is in the middle of an arc that is just sheer misery at this point,
yep,
again, don't want to spoil anything, but
yep,
people who aren't watching Succession really should be.
Yep.
You know, he told me when I explained to him that I viewed the show as a dark comedy with veins of tragedy, he's like, yeah, no, I view it as a tragedy with veins of comedy. That's, you know, and from his perspective and his character's perspective, that's exactly very clearly what it is. On the other hand, if you don't think that the show has comedic elements after watching Alan Ruck's eulogy in this episode, that's all I will say on that. That is one of the great pieces of comic writing and,
yeah,
comic performance you could watch on television.
I agree. I totally agree.
It is both of those things. I still think primarily it is a dark comedy because I laughed at more of the episode than made me sad, but it definitely does both of those,
yeah,
things.
And I'm thinking to myself, well, how can we make this show better? Is it possible to make this show better? Holly Hunter. Well, I mean, my God. I mean, let's add to this cast. Let's just put Holly Hunter in. I mean, this is amazing.
They are doing an amazing job of just introducing people, and they don't necessarily need to stay over long. So I don't know how much. I haven't gotten to this week's episode yet.
Yeah.
So I don't know if she's coming back and how prominently, in the same way that, you know, Danny Houston has been popping up occasionally. It's just like, whatever, okay, sure, Danny Houston's a part of this universe. He doesn't need to be a central part. He just,
yeah,
pops up when he pops up. And Danny Houston is an actor who, when he is ill-used, can be genuinely horrible. I think he sometimes can misgauge the tone of a piece entirely. Within this context, he's brilliant and perfect and couldn't be better used.
Yeah.
But the whole cast is so good, and it is such a good show, and having Lodge 49, there are just some really great things on at the moment, and but Succession is on a tear, and Jeremy Strong was a incredibly smart and thoughtful interview, and folks can check it out on The Hollywood Reporter.
Yeah, it is. It's The Hollywood Reporter. Check out the fine print. We have a link on our Facebook page to take you directly to that. Okay, Dan, hang on, okay?
Sure.
All right, Dan Feinberg is with us. Lots more TV to talk about. He joins us every other week, TV critic for The Hollywood Reporter, and check him out at Facebook and Twitter at The Fine Print, FIEN, and we have a link on our Facebook page, too, at facebook.com/NickDShow. More after this on 720 WGN. Right. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, and we are live in the Skyline studio and right here until 5 a.m. Triple Play Thursday. Get your request in now. One artist, three songs, 312-981-7200. And let's get back to our conversation. Dan Feinberg joins us biweekly to talk TV, TV critic for The Hollywood Reporter. You can follow him on Twitter and Facebook at The Fine Print, FIEN. Dan, welcome back.
Thank you, Nick.
All right, so tell us about Wu-Tang and American Saga. This is on Hulu, and I've been seeing a lot of press about it, and I'm really curious about it. What did you think?
It has definitely been a year of Wu-Tang Clan origin stories,
yeah,
and nothing wrong with that, because I'm always happy to spend more quality time with the Woo, and to have more excuses to listen to Enter 36 Chambers, etc. This one, in contrast to Showtime's Of Mice and Men, is actually a scripted drama series with actors, but the RZA, who was an executive producer, but maybe hands-off on the Showtime documentary, was actually a co-creator here with Alex Tsai, and he wrote the first couple episodes, or co-wrote, rather, and is an executive producer, as are many of the surviving members of the Wu-Tang Clan, and also Old Dirty Bastard's estate. And basically, it picks up in the early 90s in New York City, in Staten Island, and it traces the very, very beginnings of the individuals who would come together to form the Wu-Tang Clan. And it is very much an ongoing scripted series. It is not a mini series or a limited series, I don't believe. I've seen 8 of the 10 episodes of the first season, and it only barely is, you know, the tip of the iceberg in terms of introducing these characters, in terms of, you know, introducing their talents and showing sort of how they got propelled to stardom. So I think, you know, at the pace at which they're going, I'm really looking forward to season 2 or season 3 of it. I kind of wish there had been a little bit more energy and flair to the first season. It's kind of tiptoeing around a lot of innovative things that kind of capture the influences of the Wu-Tang Clan, whether it's martial arts movies or comic books or just sort of general pop culture of the moment. It tiptoes around using those stylistic flourishes and the grammar of those genres in its storytelling. To me, it didn't do quite enough, and I would have liked more commitment to being innovative in depicting a group that has been so innovative. Mm.
Okay, it's an interesting cast, though. To play these guys. Now, how much did the remaining members of Wu-Tang have over the casting? Did they have any power over who played who?
I don't think so. I think probably RZA had the most control, because he was sort of the active executive producer,
right,
and also the creator of the show, whereas most of the others were probably there just kind of monitoring the way in which they were being generally depicted. But the thing is, because, you know, self-mythologizing has been so central to the group entirely, it's not like there's all that much that you could say about any of these guys and the things they were doing before they broke with Wu-Tang Clan that would become scandalous. You know, if you've seen Of Mice and Men, they're perfectly happy to just sit there and talk about, yeah, we were dealing drugs, we were, you know, people were getting shot all around us, et cetera, et cetera. That was just the life we were living before this happened. And so, you know, it's definitely not a very whitewashed version of their story. It definitely is a, you know, here they are, they're selling crack in 2 different corners of Staten Island, and that was kind of where things started. So, yeah, that's where it starts and where it goes.
Okay. All right. So that's Wu-Tang Clan and American Saga, which is now on Hulu. Are they doing what Hulu normally does and just releasing a couple and then doing it weekly?
Yes, I believe that the first 3 episodes were dropped yesterday and
okay,
will then be weekly. And it's very good. A lot of the young actors are varying degrees of recognizable, and it's interesting to watch some of them play. And some of the actors are rappers in their own right. So, you know, people who are fans of New York City hip hop might know Dave East, who was featured in the Netflix hip-hop documentary series, and he's playing Method Man. No one's actually calling him Method Man at this point. You have to sort of be aware of, to some degree, where these people are going. I think it is a series that requires a certain amount of foreknowledge, so I almost think people should watch at least the first couple installments of Mice and Men, which I loved, and that way it gives you a primer on what's coming to some degree, because it really does help if you know who each of these individual actors are and who the characters are and where they're eventually going to be. I think that helps the storytelling a lot.
Okay, great. I'm looking forward to it. Wu-Tang and American Saga on Hulu, which three episodes are already up, and then every Wednesday they'll drop another one for streaming. Okay, you wrote a critic's notebook piece, and even though the show has ended, we have to talk about Baskets. Even though it's not on anymore, you wrote a piece called "The End of Baskets and the Struggle of Loving Niche TV." I love that idea. We talk about stuff that not a lot of people. We were just talking about Lodge 49 not too long ago. Baskets was the final episode of Baskets. I mean, the season was spectacular, and the final episode was, I thought, beautiful. I thought it was absolutely beautiful. It actually made me cry. I thought it was just great. So where did you, and by the way, we talked about, the last time you were on a couple of weeks ago before the final episode ever aired, I told you that, I love the synopses that they do for it. And it was Martha gets her cast off. The way they handled that on the show was spectacular. The way it was handled. Everything on that episode was great. I'm assuming you felt satisfied with the way Baskets ended.
Oh, I felt utterly satisfied. I don't think it was my favorite episode of the season. I think probably I preferred the three or four episodes leading up to it. But I think that the finale, I think Jonathan Crystal and company knew, whether they knew 100% or only 95% or 90%, that they weren't going to be getting a season five. I think they knew well enough that they knew that they had to be resolving things. And unlike The Wire, which we talked about earlier, I felt like it was a very organic piece of attempting to resolve things. And it didn't feel like it violated or cheapened any of the themes of the show. It simply put the characters on a somewhat more resolved path without necessarily giving quote-unquote closure, because it's not like the show had any big, lingering questions or anything. And I found it really satisfying, and I was glad that they got to resolve it as much as they did and that they got to take it where they wanted it to go, and I'll miss the show. And the point of the column I wrote was that, you'd think that this 500 scripted show universe with a zillion channels and streaming services. And I mean, next week, Walmart is releasing a streaming show, for heaven's sake.
Oh my God.
Vudu, which will be a Walmart streaming affiliated channel in some way, is releasing a TV version of Mr. Mom that I haven't seen a single second of other than a trailer. It's such a weird world for television. And yet these little shows that are niche shows, they're not necessarily living forever. It's not like people are saying, okay, well, you can just go and tell your story. So if you're a fan of Patriot, you didn't get resolution on that show. Yeah. If you were a fan of the OA, you didn't get resolution on that show. If you're a fan of a bunch of these really small shows, you're going to feel as if you aren't getting resolution. So it's important to champion the things that you love. It's important to go out there and say, I love this thing, and even if it's only the 270 of you who are going to love it also, talk about the things you love and see if you can get it to 280 or 290. See if Lodge 49 can find another dozen viewers thanks to us talking about it.
Yeah.
And it's just tough because you want to nurture the special little weird shows, and Baskets was a weird show. Lodge 49 is a weird show, but isn't it satisfying when you find the group of people who love the weird things
Yeah.
that you love?
Yeah, it is. It's great. And it ended beautifully. And like I said, it made me tear up when Chip referred to Ken as dad. I pretty much lost it at that. I pretty much lost it at that point. Just such subtle stuff like that. It was a great show, and I was happy that it ran for the seasons that it did run. And I'm sad to see it go, but man, it was great. It really was great.
And it's a reassuring thing to be able to tell viewers for future purposes, four seasons, but it's four seasons, and you aren't going to get to the end feeling as if you were left, dangling, and that you didn't get what you wanted. If you check in on Baskets now, yes, it's over, but you can just settle in and watch it. It's four seasons, and you'll like where it goes if you like what the weird thing it does.
Yeah, okay. I agree with everything you said there, Dan. All right, Dan, hang on, okay?
Sure.
All right, Dan Feinberg is with us, Hollywood reporter, TV critic. You can follow him on Facebook and Twitter at The Fine Print, F-I-E-N. We'll come back and talk more with Dan about TV right after this. Welcome back, everyone. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the WGN Skyline Studio, 18 stories above beautiful downtown Chicago. It's Triple Play Thursday. Get your requests in now. One artist, three songs. 312-981-7200. 312-981-7200. And this weekend, It Chapter 2 opens up. A much anticipated sequel to the unbelievably successful It from a couple of years ago, and the continuation of the very long and very popular Stephen King novel. So in honor of a big horror movie opening this weekend, we're going to talk about some of the most fascinating facts about our favorite horror movies, and we'll talk about some of the scariest books ever written. So that's all coming up. We want to hear from you. We'd love for you to contribute, and you can at 312-981-7200 for talk and text. You can also follow us on Twitter at Nick D Show and stay connected with us on our Facebook page at facebook.com/Nick D Show. Before we get to that, talk a little bit more here with Dan Feinberg, who joins us every other week, TV critic for The Hollywood Reporter. And you can check him out on Twitter and Facebook at The Fine Print, F-I-E-N. Dan, welcome back.
Thank you, Nick.
All right. So, The Dark Crystal. Now I'm a little... I'm a little old to have been fascinated by that film. I was 18 when it came out, and I was never really, you know, I thought it was okay. I thought it was fine, but I know people who absolutely love it, and it was an essential part of their childhood, and a lot of people feel the same way about Labyrinth as well. I like Labyrinth more than The Dark Crystal, but Dark Crystal is now on Netflix, and it's The Dark Crystal: Age of Resistance. Tell us about this.
It is a prequel to the movie that was directed by Jim Henson and Frank Oz way back in the day. I was a little bit younger, and it was more a part of my demographic conversation, but I don't think I ever thought it was a great movie. And rewatching it ahead of Age of Resistance, I still don't think it's a great movie. I think that it is visually marvelously innovative. I think that the puppeteering is generally tremendous and as good as it got at that moment. I think the entire movie suffers because the main characters, the Gelfling heroes, are beyond boring. They're just dismal characters, and they're the weakest puppets in the movie.
Yeah.
The series, which is 10 episodes, is a massive leap forward or advancement in the overall technology, but it doesn't like replace it. And I think it's important to acknowledge the puppeteering in the movie is for the most part remarkable, and so nothing should be taken away from that. But the new version is heavily puppeteering it, but it's also little bits of CG. Sometimes it feels a tiny bit too much. You know, they're sort of smoothing over things and erasing the poles and the wires when they exist, or the puppeteers when they would have been visible otherwise. It is, in terms of storytelling and character, it is such a massive step forward from the movie. They're almost incomparable. It's actually just a good piece of storytelling, and the characters are wonderfully likable and endearing. The vocal cast is ridiculous. It is such an amazing vocal cast that, like, Alicia Vikander, who, you know, did win an Oscar just a few years ago, she pops up in an episode. It's just like, okay, whatever, fine. She's a muppet.
Yeah, that list of the voice cast is insane. I mean, it's crazy.
And it's a lot of fun, and sometimes you recognize their voices. Like, Jason Isaacs is the voice of the main Skeksi, the villainous creature, and you recognize his voice because he sounds like himself, and Eddie Izzard has a small part, which sounds like him, and then there's the assortment of people who are doing the kind of Jim Henson, Frank Oz, Muppet voice, so it sounds a little bit Grovery or Yoda-y, and so those people include, like, Simon Pegg is doing one of those voices. Andy Samberg pops up in a very broadly comedic role. But the vocal cast is amazing. You actually feel some emotions, and not just the general awe of being impressed with the production. The entire thing was directed by Louis Leterrier, who
I run hot and cold on that guy.
Totally. Yeah. He's done some interesting genre stuff. I think if you watched his early movies, you watched The Transporter and a couple of his earlier things, you would have gone, okay, here's a kind of guy who does good, solid B movies, and that's good. You know, like, good on him for that. But then you watch a couple of his later things. You watch something like the bloated Clash of the Titans remake, and you'd be like, okay, yeah, total hack.
Yeah.
Like, where did the good stuff go? And The Incredible Hulk is sort of in between. I think it is not a bad movie, but it's not all that interesting. But here, he directed all 10 episodes, and it is a genuine achievement. It really is. It never feels stagey or wooden. There are action beats. There are emotional beats that hit home. I think if you watch the movie, you would discover that the action is, that there's a limit to what they can do. It's a very clear limit, and you can see where they just simply couldn't do things, and where emotional beats fell short because the Gelflings couldn't emote sufficiently. It's all gone. I'm not going to tell anyone that this needed to be 10 hours, the series. It's long, and it does feel a little excessive at a lot of points, but you understand why they made it. You understand why this was a continued story they wanted to tell, and it's really impressive. I think this is it's satisfying in a way that played to grown-up me without pandering to my nostalgia, because my nostalgia is mixed already. It was just entertaining for me.
Okay. So, wow. Yeah. Okay. That's impressive. That's a great review. I'm kind of surprised at that. But
I think if you watch, your initial reaction will be, I'm not sure I'm getting into I'm not sure if I really care about the world or any of this, but it's really pretty. And
okay.
At a certain point, you just start to care.
Wow. Okay. Very cool. All right. That's on Netflix. And is that streaming already?
Yep. It is streaming already. All available in totality. It is probably, I would say it is too dark for the smallest of children, but I would also say that for people of my generation, a lot of people I know were scarred by how dark and freaky certain parts of the movie were as well. I would not recommend it for the smallest of children, but I think it probably plays well to, people 10 and up. I'm making up a number there.
Okay.
Some discretion. It's a little scary and disturbing in places, but it's also really good.
Okay, cool. All right, some announcements from Saturday Night Live have happened. It comes back September 28th. Leslie Jones has left, which I was surprised by. I didn't think she was gonna leave. I'm not a fan of Leslie Jones, quite frankly, but I was surprised by her departure. What did you think of that move?
Well, we don't know the exact logistics of what, the thought process was. That I think basically what we're saying is that she wanted to, do other things, and she's an utterly unique situation because she was significantly older when she started getting her on-screen appearances.
Yep.
And when she became a regular, she is kind of without precedent in terms of becoming a cast regular and a star at the point at which she did. So it is totally fair to my mind for her to say, whatever the rest of my career is, I want to see what my opportunities are. So
yeah.
Totally cool with that. I'm not going to miss her in the sketches. She was a hit and miss sketch performer. I think she did get better. But, you know, she always seemed to have problems reading the cue cards. But then again, so did Robert De Niro, and he got nominated for an Emmy. So, you know, let's not pretend that Leslie Jones is in some way unique. You know, for heaven's sakes, Christopher Walken is an SNL hosting legend for being able to badly read cue cards.
Yeah.
So,
I mean, one of the reasons why the cowbell sketch has gone on in history is because Christopher Walken is just looking. He has no connection with anything that's happening on stage, and that's one of the reasons.
Exactly.
That's one of the reasons why it's been revered so much. Like, Christopher Walken is totally into the teleprompter or the cue cards. Meanwhile, he doesn't even know that anybody's breaking on stage or what's happening. So that's one of the reasons why. Go ahead.
Yeah, and so I don't think Leslie Jones had like moments like that, obviously. But I think on the other hand, if you watched the way that she interacted with Colin Jost and made him break, and the way that she basically humanized him in a way that I'm not sure anyone else is really capable of doing. A couple of the other interacting people do similar things, but I will miss her on Weekend Update. I think that what she did was unique and different there, and her voice will be missed. I will miss her, I would say, in the balance. And I think she's extremely funny in some ways and maybe not so funny in other ways, but I think that all she has to do is keep plugging away, and I think she'll find some of the things that she does very well. And if nothing else, you know, her Twitter videos during the Olympics and Game of Thrones and all of that, I think she is tremendous at reacting to things, and I look forward to seeing what she does next.
They've announced five of the hosts. The season premiere is going to be Woody Harrelson, which I liked. I mean, he hasn't hosted it in 5 years, but I think Woody Harrelson will be very funny. He was funny the last time he hosted. And man, I'm so excited. I bet you're excited too. Phoebe Waller-Bridge is hosting. That's going to be great.
I think the Phoebe Waller-Bridge Taylor Swift episode ought to be a classic. I hope that they give her as much wiggle room and leeway to actually give input as she is physically capable of doing. She's a busy person. I don't expect she's going to sit in the writer's room, you know, for 10 days leading up. But as much as they want to let her steer what her experience is, the show would benefit from that. I am very much looking forward to that episode.
October 12th, David Harbour from Stranger Things. I'm interested to see that. I think he'll do a good job.
I think it'll be fine. I'm not like excited about it in the same way that I am about Phoebe Waller-Bridge or a couple of the later people.
November 2nd, Kristen Stewart. I loved the episode that she hosted, and she dropped the F-bomb during her monologue, if I remember correctly. And I'm looking forward to that.
She's good.
Yeah.
She is a good SNL host, and I think that was why they announced her early, and then the other person.
Well, the other one, of course, is Eddie Murphy, who is coming back in, what, 34, since 1984 is the last time he hosted, was in 1984. The ratings are going to be through the roof for that one, no question.
I think there will be definite curiosity, and I am just taking a wait-and-see attitude.
Me too.
Because there was all of the hype about, you know, him coming back for the 30th anniversary, and that did not materialize as anything actually good.
Yeah.
And my concern would be, you know, it's one thing for bygones to be bygones and for him to be willing to come back and all that, but okay, so that's good. Okay, what you're going to do?
Yeah.
And I'm curious. But, you know, these return nostalgia appearances are often very good. Adam Sandler was surprisingly
good. Yeah, surprisingly good. Well,
if they find a way to balance, again, a little bit like Dark Crystal, nostalgia and actually Eddie Murphy, you know, being as funny as he is or he isn't. I think that is what it will come down to. But I'm very curious about that. Looking forward to Kristen Stewart and very excited about Phoebe Waller-Bridge.
Yeah, I agree with you on all of those assessments. I'm looking forward to it. Well, listen, you know, the next time we talk will be post Emmys.
Slightly pre Emmys, I believe.
Oh, is it pre Emmys? Oh, the 23rd is the Emmys. Yeah.
Yes.
Okay, I was getting confused. I got confused because when I looked it up online, they gave me the Creative Arts Emmys date, and I went, "Oh, okay."
So we will be able to maybe talk about that.
Yeah.
You know, there's always
Yeah, we can.
Those have guest actors and a few technical things.
Right.
So that'll be cool. And then we'll definitely be able to preview the Emmys, and that should be fun. I think the Emmys should be interesting and maybe unpredictable this year, or else maybe it'll just be deep in Game of Thrones and whatever.
All right. Well, yeah, Dan, always a pleasure, and we will talk to you in a couple of weeks.
Talk to you soon, Nick.
Okay, take care. Dan Feinberg, everybody, from The Hollywood Reporter. He talks to us every 2 weeks about TV. And the next time we will preview the Emmys and talk more about the new fall season, because he'll be able to preview a lot of that, too. Okay, we'll take a break here on 720 WGN.